This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, Anne Jones with you on Off Track, the ABC's dedicated nature program. Each week, I bring you stories and sounds from all over our beautiful country, but today, I'm taking you to the other side of the world with a program from BBC Discovery. This episode delves deep into animal senses. We know that birds can see in ultraviolet light, and some fish can feel electricity. But how do animals sense time? Here's presenter Jeff Marsh.
If you've ever sat and watched birds flying around and catching insects on the wing, or squirrels leaping between trees at breakneck speeds like furry little tree ninjas, it's hard not to imagine that they live their lives at different speeds. It's like they have superpowers.
Some current scientific thinking is that although we can see and hear these animals, they are literally living their lives at a different speed to us. So they're almost in a different time.
I'm Jeff Marsh, and on this episode of Discovery for the BBC World Service, I'm taking inspiration from this interview that I conducted with BBC wildlife sound recordist Chris Watson. He sparked my fascination with the idea that time might be experienced differently by different animals. It's a strange idea. Squirrels, tortoises, pesky flies, they're all living in the same world as me, with the same physical laws and largely similar senses, picking up light, sound, touch. But what about their sense of time? We've all felt the frustration of trying and failing to swat a fly with a rolled up newspaper. But if I were to miraculously dive into the mind of a fly, would a second still feel like my second? Or would I see the newspaper coming at me in super slow motion?
A second is a second, as far as this conversation is concerned. But for their second, there's so much more information that their brain might perceive it basically feeling like a long time.
This is Dr. Kevin Healy, an evolutionary biologist from the University of Ireland, Galway.
Certainly they will be seeing that newspaper coming down, every little movement and detail in it, and they can react to it in the best way. So for them, it's just kind of sidestepping out of the way.
There seems to be some basis to the idea that flies, at least, are doing more with the same amount of time. And in this programme, I'll be searching for the science that might show how different species are able to react so quickly. But by trying to get inside the minds and experiences of different animals, we'll unavoidably stray into philosophy. There was a famous paper written in 1974 by philosopher Thomas Nagel called What Is It Like to Be a Bat? Sadly, for our purposes, this was not a candid first bat person account of nocturnal life on the wing, but rather a rhetorical question that makes the point that we'll never be able to understand the conscious experience of another animal. So should we even be asking the question of what time feels like for different species? Here's theoretical physicist Carlo Rovelli.
I see no difficulty in thinking that there could be temporal perceptions that are profoundly different from the one we usually commonly experience in our everyday life.
So you would say it's a worthy pursuit to try and work out what
Absolutely.
It's like to be a bat?
Absolutely. I think we should.
But why would anyone even think that animals could have a different perception of time to ourselves?
One of the things we often kind of overlook is that if you fly, you need to catch things on the wing. You need to get up-to-date information that's really precise, because even if you get it slightly wrong, you'd miss your prey or you get eaten.
Kevin studies vision across the animal kingdom. This could be a good way to get some actual data on how quickly animals are able to sense time.
Can we measure how good animals are measuring time themselves, or how many events they can see in a given time? And what we do is we use a thing called the flicker fusion rate. The flicker fusion rate gets its name from how we actually measure that, and that's using a light that flashes on or off. The light is either on or off. So you flash it really slowly at the start, and you keep increasing that flash rate until the animal can no longer distinguish whether the light is on or off. You just merge those two events into one. And that point is called the critical flicker fusion rate. And that's our measure of how quickly those eyes can see things. Probably whatever room you're sitting in, there's going to be lights. Those lights are probably going to be on an AC current, which means that they're flashing on and off as the current changes direction. But we can't see that. It's flashing too quickly for our eyes to perceive, because we don't have the physiology to basically keep up with that.
Right, so they are flickering, but my eyes see those flickers as fused, and that's flicker fusion rate.
Exactly. We see this huge variation in the ability of animals to effectively see time this way. To give us a perspective, humans, we're at 60, so we can see 60 frames per second. That's pretty good. Down at the bottom, if we stick with vertebrates, I think the lowest is in a fish called a scaller, which is a deep sea fish. In its typical environment, it can only see about 1 or 2 frames per second. At the other end, the top vertebrate is a bird, and that's the pied flycatcher. So that's an animal that catches flies while it's flying. And that can see about 145 at its top limit. So really, really quite high. However, to get to the most extreme animals, you're looking at flies and beetles, things like that. So the blowfly can see about 200 frames per second. That's going to be able to see that the light above you is flashing. So for us, it's just a dimly lit room. For that fly, it might be like a disco strobe light thing going crazy. So they're really getting into incredible levels. The highest I've ever seen is in a species of beetle, fire beetle, and that can get rates up to 400 frames per second.
So for each second that you or I experience, our eyes are taking in about 60 pictures of the outside world, whereas for a fly, they take many more, and some animals up to 400. That's why pesky flies can dodge my newspaper. So why can't I have superhuman eyesight? Seems like a really useful trait to have this increased eye speed or temporal resolution, as it's known.
And the reason that all these animals don't have these really high perceptual abilities is because it costs energy and lots of it.
Ah, there's always a catch. So if you want super fast eyesight, it comes at a cost. So only species that really need it bother with the extra expenditure, like flies and birds, for example. But in evolution, where there's a costly trait, sometimes there's a chance to cheat the system. Dr. Kirsten Fritches spent months on a boat in the Pacific studying one animal that might be doing so.
A swordfish eye can get the size of a grapefruit. I mean, it's a really massive eye.
Why were you interested in the flicker fusion rate of a swordfish?
The swordfish and the marlin as well have this heater organ in their eye. So essentially they've changed one of their eye muscles into a heater. And so that keeps the brain warm, but it also keeps the eye warm. And I remember starting to work on swordfish that I found that intriguing. So why would you do that? This hypothesis we were working on, okay, it does something to their speed of vision, because the speed of vision is affected by temperature. We worked out that if you cool down a swordfish eye, the flicker fusion frequency is affected and drops quite dramatically if you cool it down to a cooler temperature, which it would have if it didn't heat its eyes.
Wow, so with this kind of heating organ inside the swordfish head, when they're down in the cold, they can actually heat up their eyeballs and speed up their flicker fusion rate, which means that they see at a higher frame rate when they're hunting these fast prey.
Yeah, absolutely. What you're doing is chopping up time into smaller pieces, if you want, so you can look at them in more detail to have as least blurry image as it can.
Okay, well, Kirsten didn't exactly commit to making any bold claims about the swordfish subjective experience. We still don't really know what time feels like to a swordfish. And it's no wonder that a lot of the scientists I spoke to were hesitant to contradict Nagel and hazard guesses at what it's like to be that proverbial bat. But if anyone was going to take the plunge, it was this guy.
Hi, Yossi.
You look like two young teenagers with a microphone.
Yossi Yovel is a professor of Tel Aviv University in Israel, where I met him at his bat lab to see what he could tell me about a bat's experience of time.
We will never be inside the bat's brain. I wish I could be born again as a bat, but that will probably not happen. One of the ways to get close to understanding what the bat's brain is doing is by trying to very carefully tease apart different characteristics of the echo to see what it cares about. We think it cares about time, for example. Let's manipulate time. Let's change the time of the echoes and see that it responds. So I think I'll bring one of the bats that is going to be trained so you can see what a bat looks like from a short distance.
Yep, you heard that right. Yossi trains bats. And he's bringing one to me.
Okay.
So this is, like I said, it's a big brown bat. It's an adult. Now you can see that she's echolocating. Actually, you cannot hear it because it's ultrasonic. Maybe later we can bring a bat detector and then you would hear it.
But I can see her mouth quivering, yeah.
Exactly, I can feel her shivering, you know, when she's emitting sound.
As if she could get any cuter, I discovered that this bat's name was Abigail. Oh, and that sound she was producing is her echolocation. That's how she, in radio inverted commas, sees the world. She sends out a click, her ears wait to see how long it takes to bounce back, and that's how she gets a sense of her spatial environment. Yossi works with Abigail in this specialised room that we're in, surrounded by high-speed cameras and microphones that record the bat's behaviour in great detail.
So we're using this virtual reality setup, which allows us to record the bat signals, echolocation signals, and then manipulate them, and then emit sounds back to the bat, so the bat perceives objects that are not necessarily there.
So you're essentially changing the time it takes for that signal to come back. You're messing with its mind.
Right. So if we have the first echo played back after a delay of 10 milliseconds, and then the next echo after 15 milliseconds, and then the next one after 20 milliseconds, for the bat, this should seem like the object is moving backwards, right? It's moving away from it while it is not doing this.
What do you understand about a bat's perception of time?
First, I want to say something about flicker fusion and the equivalent maybe with bats. And bats depend on sound emission in order to receive information. So whenever they, when using echolocation, when using sonar or when using sound, they emit sound and then receive echoes, right? So they will only update sensory information input when they emit sound. So this means they can actually control their acoustic flicker fusion rate, if you wish, and they do so. So when a bat is flying in an empty environment where there are few obstacles and perhaps lower chances to encounter prey, it will sometimes emit sounds only once per second. That would be equivalent to a flicker fusion rate of 1 hertz, which is very, very slow. On the other hand, a bat can change and it can go up to rates of 200 emissions per second when it is, for example, at the last final stage of attacking an insect. So the bat can, and bats constantly adjust this rate. So the rate in which they acquire information about the world is according to how fast they want to acquire information and what is the task they are performing. Are they hunting prey? Are they in an environment with a lot of obstacles where you have to constantly and quickly know what's going to change, what's happening? Those are things that bats can adjust. Sometimes, you know, I don't play this at home, but I ride my bike and I try opening and closing my eyes at 1 hertz, so like the minimal rate of a bat, and to see, do I acquire enough information in order to navigate using a bicycle? It's an interesting experience. Mm. I try to do it when there are no cars around, of course.
That's great. So they can completely choose the resolution of their sensory environment to match the needs of the situation they're in.
Right. At least sensorically, the rate of updating sensory information changes, and that means you are now perceiving the world faster or slower.
It's amazing that they can ramp up their temporal resolution by 200 times when they're zeroing in on a moth. But what does this mean for how fast time seems to be passing for them during these intense moments? It's still hard to know. But on the other hand, it's hard not to imagine that cranking up the amount of information you're taking in every second 200-fold wouldn't have a profound impact on your sense of time.
We like to say the brain translates time into distance according to the speed of sound, right? So if you have time and you know speed, you can translate this into distance. But we don't know that the bat does this. Perhaps the whole world is actually encoded in the bat's brain just based on time.
When you hear Yossi put it like that, it makes you think perhaps Thomas Nagel actually had a point. It actually hurts my brain to try and think bat.
So I'll just let her go.
Oh.
Do you remember Chris Watson, the sound recordist you heard at the top of the programme? He had some really interesting thoughts about the different temporal worlds that animals exist in and how much information might be being conveyed in temporal resolutions well beyond our capabilities. Now, I'm quite excitable and my producer often leans over the table and tells me to slow down. And he has a point, because if I were to speak a lot faster, for a while you'd still be able to understand what I was saying, but then you'd start to only catch the odd phrase, and maybe even individual words, until eventually it would be impossible to decipher what I was saying, because your ears and brains would be overloaded with information, and to make well beyond your temporal resolution, and it would be a much less interesting program because of that. You wouldn't be able to understand anything, interesting facts that we've been telling you about, where we've been doing all sorts of different scientists about the speed of animals, size, and hearing what information in the context of environments, and how fast their eyes are refreshing, and the difference between animals, insects, vertebrates, and vertebrates, all that information for. So for that reason, also everything back down. Whereas at this pace, my words flow effortlessly into your ears and are interpreted by your brain. So our time perception is crucial for communication.
This is a Wren song, and it contains 64 separate notes in 8 seconds. Did you count all 64 notes there, Jeff?
I think so. Well, 63 I got to, and then then you cut me off.
So we imagine there's lots of information in there, but we can't understand it because it's so fast. Our brains can't resolve it. And so one way in which we can reveal it is to slow that song down. So we play it back at half the speed. This is the same song slowed down.
Well, my first thought is that that would be much easier to whistle.
Yeah.
Sort of within the whistling range, isn't it?
Yeah, it brings the pitch down by an octave, but we can start to hear that there are lots of notes in there. Even so, there's still a bit in the middle, which is sort of a blur of notes.
Just still too fast.
So we can slow it down again to a quarter of the original speed, which means the song takes four times longer to play back, but again reveals even more information, although it's starting to sound quite tropical by now.
It does sound more tropical. It's almost like a sort of bird of paradise-y type thing.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? And that's a bird that occurs in, you know, commonly in our parks and gardens, has this incredibly complex pattern of song. And we imagine within that, what it's now revealing to us is something of the wealth and depth of information that's in bird song.
I'm Bob Dooling. I'm a hearing scientist at the University of Maryland College Park.
My name is Nora Pryor. I am a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Maryland, and my research has focused on birds, mostly zebra finches and zebra finch social behavior.
If you slow down bird song, we hear all these things we didn't hear before, and people assumed, well, the birds must hear this detail. And that was kind of the issue that attracted me as an auditory scientist.
Are the birds hearing more from their bird song than we are as humans?
We think so. We think definitely so. For a complex sound, the structure, the cycle-by-cycle structure of that is perceptible to birds in a way that it is not perceptible to us.
What have you learned about the speed at which they're hearing?
If you think of birds maybe having something like an acoustic microscope where a sound is going by, but they can focus in and sort of expand. If you want to call it expanding time, I would say more like an acoustic microscope where they can see the details or hear the details that slip by us. That's where we think birds are very good and we are not so good.
And what we find is that the birds have, and zebra finches particularly, have a much better ability to discriminate the variation that exists at this level than we have, which means they're hearing things within a note that we can't hear.
These calls that you're hearing now are recordings that Nora made of zebra finches.
Am I right in thinking that the fact that there is all this information within a single note that they're picking up on must say something about their temporal resolution of their hearing?
If you think of a bird song or human speech, there's a temporal quality to that at the gross level, say word by word, or for the bird, syllable by syllable. We might miss some of those where the bird would get them. But that's not where we see the big difference. Where we see the big difference is if you pluck out an individual note, there is a temporal quality to that too. It's not an absolute pure tone. It has a structure to it. It has harmonics to it usually. And it makes subtle changes over that tenth of a second. The bird can hear those subtle changes 10 times better than we can. So it provides an avenue, a channel, for the bird to communicate information that we can't hear. And that's their level of communication.
Yeah, it's really hard to imagine how the birds might be doing this because we have to imagine it through our perceptual system. So it's very difficult to know exactly what it's like for the birds and how they're experiencing it.
Again, very hard to say whether birds are hearing these calls slowed down like we did with Chris. But Bob and Nora have been able to show that they're incredibly perceptive about changes in the temporal qualities of individual notes. They're definitely getting more out of them than we are in the same amount of time. But how could it be that two animals could have a different sense of time? Surely the same time is passing us by, whether we're radio presenters or zebra finches. It's about time I got some concrete facts about time. I met with theoretical physicist Carlo Rovelli at the BBC. He's the author of a new book, The Order of Time.
Don't think that physics provide a unique sense of law of time, which has to be the same for everybody. There isn't anything like that.
It's almost disappointing to hear you say that, Carlo, because we were thinking, well, let's just get a physicist in, because at least, you know, then we'll have something solid, immutable, something that we can stick all this to. And now you're telling me that time itself is weird.
Absolutely. I'm happy to disappoint you entirely. What is called time in physics, it's the counting of physical things happening, which is something separated from perceptual time, which is the counting of sort of mental event happening in the brain of an organism. So what we perceive as the speed of time is really the speed of our brain. It depends on the machine.
I mean, would you say, from your perspective, that it's reasonable to assume that different animals have a different sense of time?
From the perspective of a physicist like me, the answer is, I think, definitely yes. Because the perspective of time is not in physics, it's in biology. So different biology produces a different perception of time.
So there isn't a universal flow of the passage of time shared by everyone and everything. A tortoise might feel a minute the same way I feel 20 seconds. A fly could be feeling 5 seconds in the same way I feel 1 second. This pulls us back to the philosophical question of what's going on inside the mind of an animal. What does time actually feel like?
I mean, suppose we all experience the same flow of time, so to say. Then the question would be, what are we experiencing? What is this rate of passage of time that we experience? If it is so common and so objective, it would not be in biology, it would be in physics. But in the grammar of nature, there is nothing like that. The only answer I could give is comparing it to the ticking of my brain. If that works in a different manner, I see no reason why it wouldn't produce a different temporal perception.
What you seem to be saying is that our perception of time is time.
Yes, exactly. Perception of time is time for us.
So as Carlo would have it, the perception of time is something that our brains make up. He's not afraid to put himself in the shoes of a fly or a swordfish and say that yes, compared to us, time will feel different. And that's because to him, time is this construct of the events we experience. And this brings us back nicely to what Kevin was talking about with his flicker fusion rate.
Our brain is telling us what time is, effectively. Its idea of how fast things are going is just going to be how much events are there to process. If you're something like a fly, you've got loads and loads of events per second that you can process. We can get the numbers down and we can say a fly has access to those fast motion experiences that we don't. And we have access to faster motion experiences than isopods or those deep sea fish. You can get these numbers, but you can never really understand the subjective feeling, what that is for those animals.
Asking if a different animal has a different perception of time is almost a meaningless question, because it infers a comparator, doesn't it? Against which there obviously isn't, because we're never going to be a fly and a fly is never going to be us. So a fly is never going to be another fly.
That's the pure philosophy. I'll never. You can say you see red, but I can never really know your red is my red and so on. Mm. It's like that, only with the deeply philosophical idea of time on top of it. So
it seems the writing's on the wall. We'll never know what it feels like to be another animal, or even to say scientifically whether something like a fly has a conscious experience at all. Or can we?
If we want to interpret the fly as something which has no consciousness in any sense, in any weak sense, then we can't even ask the question, what is the perception of time of a fly? But to the extent in which a fly has a perception, I think we shouldn't just think, well, is instinctual and count it down, because it's a cheap answer, right? I could look at you and say, well, you are just instinctual. How do I know you have a consciousness? But I think I know you have a consciousness, you have a subjectivity, you have perceptions. And I think my cat has very similar perceptions, and why not flies? When you compare different perceptions of time, for a fly, the time goes at the proper speed at which time is supposed to go. The slow motion is compared to ours. So I would bet that when in the future we'll have a machine that allows us to communicate with flies and ask them how you feel time is passing, we'll figure out that they feel different than us.
What we do know is that animals experience the world through their senses, and different animals have different temporal resolutions, rates at which they sample the outside world, from 1 per second up to 400. This allows animals like birds to catch flies in flight and flies to dodge newspapers. I guess a part of me thinks that for a fly that only gets to live a few days, it's just a nice thought that for those few days, however irritating they may be to me, time is passing very slowly for them. It just seems fair.
A Sense of Time from BBC Discovery was produced by Rory Galloway and presented by Jeff Marsh. This is Off Track, and I'm Anne Jones. And remember to join me here at the same time next time. That's when I'll take you somewhere else.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.